Serendipitous encounters at the margins of texts. Errantry and decentralization in Ana Maria Gonçalves's Homme de Fido de Cor. Luana de Souza Sutter abstract. Since the turn of the century, several Afro-Brazilian writers have taken to engage critically with Brazil's colonial past and the absence of Afro-Brazilian voices in historical and literary discourses. Ana Maria Gonçalves's 2006 published novel Homme de Fido de Cor is a paradigmatic example of this emerging corpus as it recuperates the history of the Mali Revolt in Salvador 1835, and envisions the life of its leading figure, Laísa Mahon. This article looks into the representation of hegemonic spaces of center and periphery in Homme de Fido de Cor and the intertextual relations drawn in the narrative through the lens of the Afro-Caribbean philosopher and writer Edouard Glissant's Poetics of Relation. It argues that Homme de Fido de Cor builds on the motif of serendipity to carry out a narrative of errantry and decentralization and disclose concealed Afro-Brazilian discourses in intertextual relations. Ana Maria Gonçalves's second and prize-winning novel Homme de Fido de Cor tells the saga of the female protagonist, Kehinde, from her survival from a family massacre in Savalu, through to her kidnap into the flourishing transatlantic slave trade in the Dahomey Kingdom. It follows the decades she spent in Bahia, where she comes to bear a central role in the historical Mali Revolt, until her return to Africa, resettling at the Benin coast as a wealthy businesswoman. Kehinde's first-person narrative is rendered on her deathbed during her last journey to Brazil, where she hopes to meet once again her son, Luis, and leave him, the time, that has passed, as an inheritance. Gonçalves 617, my translation, telling Luis in extensive letters the things which I would have told you if we had been together. 557, my translation, Kehinde intends to make up for her absence and the breaches in family history since their early separation. The protagonist's desire to pass on her story underscores UGC's concern with narrative reparation and the recuperation of absent voices, a concern with regards not only to the protagonist's family context but also to Brazilian history and the literary canon. Making the stance of an enslaved African woman the focal point of narrative, UGC renders a counter-narrative of Brazilian history, representing the Brazil's past from Belo, that is from the perspective of the oppressed, the enslaved. However, while UGC can be seen to clearly take issue with hegemonic relations in the production of history, it is in its overt intertextual dialogues with literature that the novel makes its counter-narrative discourse more productive. As Eduardo de Assis Duarte explains, the Brazilian novel displays, as a rule, a considerable male hegemony, be it in authorial terms, in protagonism, or in the represented universe. Duarte 22, my translation, in Kehinde's first-person narrative, Gonçalves' novel claims its own space within this predominantly male and widened Brazilian literary production, where the black feminine voice has been made invisible by hegemonic discourse. UGC takes issue with these matters of narrative focus and authorship in Brazilian literature in an elaborate intertextual dialogue with canonical texts by established authors such as Jorge Amado and Joaquim Manuel de Macedo. As this article will argue, UGC's narrative of slavery blurs the boundaries between history and literature but also between hegemonic notions of center and margins, employing intertextuality as a device for a literary decentralization of Brazilian textual production. This concern with decentralization in the novel's handling of white male-authored intertexts evinces a deep congruence of the Afro-Brazilian contemporary novel with the critical thought of the post-colonial Afro-Caribbean philosopher Edouard Glissant. This essay sets out to more closely investigate UGC's engagement with the main concepts of Glissantian theory in the intertextual sphere, tending to UGC's explicit dialogues with the Brazilian canon in the prologue and main narrative. In this analysis, I hope to stake out how the novel's narrative strategies engage with Black diasporic post-colonial discourse to reclaim Afro-Brazilian female voices within the Brazilian literary landscape. Serendipity. You don't reach Serendip by plotting a course for it. You have to set out in good faith for elsewhere and lose your bearings serendipitously. John Barth, The Last Voyage of Somebody, The Sailor, Nova York, 1991, Gonçalves 9, accompanied by the announcing exclamation serendipities. John Barth's aphorism opens the prologue of Ana Maria Gonçalves' Homme de Fido de Cor and urges the reader to tend to the contingency of discovery pervading the novel. The prologue, written in Gonçalves' voice, begins by informing the reader that the story they are about to read derives from the reminiscent pages of Kehinde's letters to her son, found by chance in the small and poor village of Itaperica, Bahia, and edited into the final version of the novel. By account of these fictional encounters, the reader is deceptively misled into believing the artifactual status of Ketan's testimonial account, encountered by Gonsalves in a moment of serendipity, originally coined by the British writer Horace Walpole, in 1754. The term serendipity derives from Walpole's interpretation of a Persian tale translated as The Travels and Adventures of Three Princes of Serendip, 1722. As Walpole's version of the story goes, the ruling king sends away three princes on an expedition and, as their highnesses traveled, they were always making discoveries, by accidents or sagacity, of things which they were not in quest of. For instance, one of them discovered that a mule blind of the right eye had traveled the same road lately, because the grass was eaten only on the left side, where it was worse than on the right. Walpole QTD in Serendipity 2, reflecting on the accidental sagacity of the wandering princes, able to track a one-eyed mule through their sole attention to its unusual trail. Walpole dwells on the accidental workings behind these eventful discoveries, which he accordingly names serendipities. Conceived as the unusual combination of sagacity and accident, serendipity comes to address any situation where unheralded discovery takes place as a result from the oscillation of these two ingredients. After its initial mention and a brief contextualization of Walpole's neologism, Ugg makes a point in rendering its own definition of the term. Serendipity comes to refer then to that kind of situation in which we discover or find something while we were looking for something else but for which we already had to be, so to say, ready. That is to say, we need at least a bit of knowledge about what we have discovered so that the happy moment of serendipity does not pass by without us noticing. Gonsalves 9. My translation. Although it does not foreclose the role of keen perception accentuated in Walpole's first mention, the prologue's narrative voice refrains from further engaging in the individual merits of sagacity, rephrasing it to a readiness of the mind, which requires only little preparation, a bit of knowledge to realize the happy moment. Hence, serendipity does not necessarily come to illustrate those situations clearly marked by one's exceptional wits, but rather those which, closer in meaning to John Barth's epigraph, presuppose receptivity and a propensity for diversion. Moreover, framing it with apostrophes, Ugg seems to suggest a relativization of the act of discovery in serendipity, suspending its realization. Did we discover it? And, did we discover it? Or else, did discovery come upon us? Following these subtle hints of doubt, Ugg's prologue offers two episodes which will foreground other elements integral to the workings of serendipity. Serendipitous Encounters with Texts. Some Defeat au Decor is a product of serendipity. Ibid, my translation, claims the prologue, and presents the reader with two serendipitous discoveries which culminate in Gonsalves's final encounter with Ketan's letters. The first unexpected discovery takes place in a bookshop, where Gonsalves was looking for a travel guide for Cuba and, suddenly, separating some travel guides to go through them with more calm, several of them fell from the shelf as domino pieces, and I could only hold on to one, before it too would fall to the ground. It was Jorge Amado's Bahia de Todos os Santos Julia de Ruiz y Misterios. There, my first serendipity took place. 10. My translation. After rescuing Amado's Bahia de Todos os Santos Julia de Ruiz y Misterios de Cidade de Salvador, Bahia of All Saints, A Guide to the Streets and Mysteries of Salvador, 1945. From the avalanche of books, Gonsalves's look briefly diverts to the pages laid open in the prologue, Convite, Invitation, and When the Guitar Weeps in the Hand of the Serenade Singers on the Frantic Street of the Most Agitated City. Do not, lady, linger any minute on indecision. Answer the call and come. Bahia waits for you in its daily fest. Come and I will be your guide. I just had no idea of what to do in Bahia, but when the moment is of serendipity, things just happen. That is why, a few pages ahead, I found the following text of Alifa Lacuta. Who knows the name, the traces, the knowledge, the gesture, and the face of the man? He commanded the revolt of enslaved blacks for 4 days and the city of Bahia had him as his ruler as the Mali nation rose to the dawn of liberty, breaking the shackles, and wielded the weapons declaring the equality of men. I don't know of a story of struggle more beautiful than that of the Mali people, nor of a revolt repressed with such violence. About the revolt and its leader not much is known. At the most, silence. It is the case of asking where are the young historians from Bahia, some of such quality and intellectual courage, who do not take up to research the Mali revolt, and who do not bring up the magnificent figure of the leader. Topic for a great novel. 10.1. My translation. Weaving Jorge Amado's Convite into the prologue's narrative, Ug summons Bahia de Todos os Santos as a pretext and pretext for the writer's unheralded engagement with the story of Bahia's Mali revolt. Convite renders two approximations of historiographical approaches that set the pillar for Gonçalves's upcoming project. First, it replaces the historian's missing work on the Mali revolt with the vision of a great novel, acknowledging an analogous value between historical and fictional representations of the past, which propels the author's research in Bahia. Secondly, as an invitation that simultaneously proposes a touristic visit and historical revisitation, Convite introduces an approximation between local and narrative explorations, which will pervade Ugg's narrative, lingering on Amato's conclusion over the failure or disinterest of native historians in engaging with the Malis history and its remediation through the creative contributions of visitors that would come to form a great novel. Gonçalves takes thus a double cue from Convite. She decides to go to Salvador, where she intends to walk through the streets where the Malis had walked, enter the churches they had once entered, swim in the sea where they had once swum, because I knew that if I weren't in loco, I wouldn't finish the book. 11. My translation. The aspiring writer is convinced that although I did not belong to the category of young historians from Bahia, it was clear that it was directed to me, the provocation about writing a novel. Ibid. My translation. Building on the appellative tone of Amato's text, the writer not only claims to accept its invitation but also reclaims the position of its intended addressee, rendering Ugg the product of an accepted call set out directly to her. The belief that Convite was addressed to her induces a suspension of contingency in the event of discovery that does not quite befit the original idea of chance and serendipity. However, this apparent suspension does not necessarily renounce the surprise effect of serendipity but prompts at this moment rather a less orthodox reading of Walpole's concept, setting aside the inherent tension between casualty and causality to foreground another of its determinant traits, diversion. Analogous to the serendip prince's wandering focus, in Ugg, serendipity is affected by the ability to divert attention to one's surrounding spaces and peripheral texts. The unexpected encounter with Amato's prologue deviates Gonçalves from the original purpose of her search, after which her travel destination is replaced and discarded. I think I left the travel guides about Cuba on the floor, mesmerized by what I had just discovered. Ibid. My translation. Once in Bahia, it is again her propensity to divert from the intended path that emerges as a propitious device for inquiring Salvador's Mali history. Following her arrival in Bahia's capital, Gonçalves visits the village of Itaperica, a small province located in a neighboring island about 10 kilometers away from the city of Salvador, and, after falling in love with one of the village stories told by a local resident, she decides to move to Itaperica. This spontaneous decision to reside outside the site of her inquiries reveals another movement of deviation in the prologue's narrative, a movement which proves itself fruitful once. Soon after starting her research, Gonçalves comes across an investigative dead end. She finds in Bahia a large amount of material already written on the Malis and realizes that a lot more people beside me and ahead of me have accepted Jorge Amado's invitation. I gave up the idea of writing the book about the Malis. 13. My translation. At this moment, the prologue reveals the writer's illusory and biased reading of Amato's Convite, where Gonçalves's own wish to accept the challenge of historical discovery took the lead of interpretation. Such a desiring reading illustrates a mode of perception Slavoj Zizek has termed looking awry or looking from aside. Leaning on Lacan's desire theory, Zizek posits that, if we look at a thing straight on, that is, from a matter of fact, disinterested, objective perspective, we see nothing but a formless spot. The object assumes clear and distinctive features only if we look at it from a side, that is, with an interested look, with a look supported, permeated, and distorted by a desire. Zizek 34. Similarly, in Ugg, the aspiring writer's desire for discovering a dismissed narrative distorts Amato's invitation. Before Gonçalves' desiring eye, Convite comes to assume its full meaning and purpose only at the fateful moment its proposition is accepted by its original addressee herself. The writer's understanding of Convite derives from her own desire to break the silence around the Brazilian counter-narrative, the barely known beautiful story of the Malis oppressed struggle. Nonetheless, after acknowledging previous engagements with the history of the Mali revolt, Gonçalves resigns the self-claimed position of Convite's exclusive recipient, but not her own wish to summon missing histories. She then sets her mind on a new book project about a historical event in San Luis do Maranhão, about which she assured herself that not much had yet been written. This reorientation foregrounds the writer's desire to engage overturned historical narratives in literature and, moreover, opens the way for a second serendipity. While Convite endorsed an approximation of literature and history central to the validation of UGC's counter-narrative discourse, the revelation of the researcher's deceptive look awry reveals that such an approximation demands a particular kind of endeavor, which I will call intertextual errantry. Intertextual errantry in Poetics of Relation. Edward Glissant explains the visionary and unbiased workings of errance or errantry as follows. Errantry does not proceed from renunciation nor from frustration regarding a supposedly deteriorated deterritorialized situation of origin. It is not a resolute act of rejection or an uncontrolled impulse of abandonment. He thought of errantry as also the thought of what is relative, the thing relate as well as the thing related. Glissant 18. In accordance with Glissant's notion of errantry, in UGC, the discovered texts about the malice do not prompt an abrupt renunciation of Gonsalves' engagement with Brazil's invisible narratives but rather restate the need, in serendipity, to allow for things to just happen. Accepting Amado's call and later the existence of other texts on the Mali history thus become important steps in the writer's process of exploration, where Gonsalves acknowledges the things relate as much as the things related. This discloses the discovery of Convite to be only the first movement of diversion towards the blind spots of Brazilian history. Before leaving for Maranhão, Gonsalves pays one last visit to Itaperica to hand the portraits she promised to Vanessa, a little girl she had met in the village church months ago. Carrying only the little girl's portrait as a reference, Gonsalves asks around for directions to Vanessa's residence and finally arrives at a very simple house, without pavement, without number, and at a dead-end street. Gonsalves 14. My translation. There, Dona Clara, Vanessa's mother, invited me to have a cup of coffee and, when I entered her living room, I noticed an unusual coffee table, with the glass top sustained by piles and piles of paper and magazines. I complimented them, saying that it was good to know that someone there enjoyed reading. Dona Clara said that this was not really the case, that she used the magazines to support the tabletop, but that they also came in handy when the children had to cut out images for some school homework. Regarding the papers, the youngest son, who was 6 years old, used them to draw on the side that had not been used yet. Ibid. My translation. The six-year-old boy, Gerson, used the backside of paper sheets his mother had found in the old church basement, when she had been asked by the local priest to clean the facilities and throw away any old piece of paper. Instead of fulfilling the priest's request, Clara decided to keep the old papers and magazines for the children's entertainment. While Gonsalves still waits for Vanessa, Clara asks her son to come show his work to the special guest. Gerson, enthusiastic with his new audience, ran into the house and returned with sheets and more sheets of drawings. Nothing special, but I looked at them attentively and even complimented him because, with some incentive, the boy could maybe improve. You never know where great talents hide. Turning one of the sheets around, which looked yellowed with age and had let the fountain pen handwriting soak through to the sides of the drawings, I realized what looked like a document written in old Portuguese, with tiny and very well-drawn letters, and a continuous writing, almost out of breath or punctuation. The reading of that sheet was already very compromised, not only through the interference of the boy's drawing on its opposite side, but also because it looked like it had been made on a porous surface, which might have well been the naked concrete floor of the living room, which left deeply carved traces and caused it to tear on some spots. I took another sheet, this time with a smaller drawing on it, and as I turned it around, the first word I could read was Lacutan. 15. My translation and emphasis. Spotting the name of the Malice former leader, Lacuta, written in Old Portuguese, concretizes Gonsalves' second moment of revelation. Here, although the prologue does not conclude this to be the aspiring writer's second and most happy serendipity, 14. Which is previously announced but not explicitly indicated like the first, its certainty is implied. First, due to this passage's clear mention of Lacuta and reference to the novel's main text, and second, in Gonsalves' recognition of the relevance of the manuscript, the handwritten letter fragments surpass her initial expectation of finding artifactual evidence that could underpin her writing and convey much more than I had dared to look for. 16. My translation. Culminating in the discovery of this first-hand account of the Mali revolt, UGC's prologue reveals the writer's errant and diverting path as a mode for engaging with the blind spots of Brazilian history. Gonsalves's serendipitous discovery of Cahan's letters derives from a series of deviations from the center stage of Bahia's historical setting and discourse to its periphery, a circular movement that enables the writer to wander off to spaces a researcher would not likely enter. Through her wanderings into uncharted territories and unceasing relations of Bahia's literary and urban landscape, the renounced researcher gradually distances herself from more obvious sites of historiographical inquiry into occluded spaces, wherein Afro-Brazilian narratives lies unaccounted for the researcher's desiring eye. The first of various sideways glances takes place when, instead of wandering through the streets of the capital, as Amado had suggested, Gonsalves trades the centered stance of the canonical writer for a secluded satellite location, an island and therein a small village, which stand in clear antithetical relation to the populous and prominent capital of Bahia. Further, engaging with this space liberated from a conditioned inquisitive glance renders Gonsalves more receptive to Bahia's uncovered narratives and invisible spaces, emphasizing the invisibility of this space to the hegemonic narrative. Vanessa's house is an unnumbered and irregular building on a nameless dead-end street, a doubly invisible locus, not only socially marginalized but also officially inexistent and only accessible through the local indication. At last, Vanessa's house conceals an unrecognized artifact of Bahia's slave past whose representative value remains unrealized to its poorly literate guardians, because of the page's poor conditions as much as the family's inability to decode their writing. Cf. 15. Cahan's letters are made once again invisible, reduced to stained paper and her testimonial words, deprived of its discursive power. In this scene, Gonsalves's last errant movement takes place on the flat surface of paper sheets, given one of Gerson's drawings and look, eyeing at them attentively so as to identify their possible hidden value. Gonsalves allows her sight to divert to the sides of the drawings and the dark stains framing it. Parting from the perimeter of the boy's drawings to their peripheral space discloses a deeper and shadowy layer soaking through from the backside of the sheets, the ghostly traces of Cahan's story insistently infiltrating the visible layer, not erased, nor overwritten, and yet, overturned and hidden from view. The child's sheets of drawing carry palimpsestic traces, which interfere on the present surface to denounce a historical narrative overturned. In Ugg's revelatory errantry from the center to margins, Glissant's thought of errantry is evoked as a propitious mode for the exploration of marginalized spaces and texts. The discovery of historical blind spots calls for an interaction that eschews an absolute forward projection, Glissant 12, and rejects the possibility to know the totality of the world, 20. Errant, he challenges and discards the universal, this generalizing edict that summarized the world as something obvious and transparent, claiming for it one presupposed sense and one destiny. He plunges into the opacities of that part of the world to which he has access. Generalization is totalitarian. From the world it chooses one side of the reports, one set of ideas, which it sets apart from others and tries to impose by exporting as a model. The thinking of errantry conceives of totality but willingly renounces any claims to sum it up or to possess it. Ibid. Along the lines of Glissant's call for a renunciation of universal truth and totalitarian knowledge, the prologue of Ugg dismisses teleological approach and arrow-like projection, 221, as proper modes to access erased counter-narratives. In place thereof, Gonsalves must renounce the desire to conquest and possess history and, moreover, evade the limited visual range of the center, whose claims of transparency, objectivity, and historical truth are the real dismissing force behind narrative gaps. This scene concludes a series of diverting movements, errant and decentralizing, performed by the writer, where she turns her attention from the center to the margins of historical sites, public spaces, and paper sheets. Like the princes in the Serendip tale, who discovered the trail of a one-eyed mule by attending to the sideways of their path, the errant explorer too must decentralize her glance to the side spaces, moving to the peripheral space of city and texts to attain more awareness of Bahia's history blind spots. Ugg's narrative seems to build on the visual effect of anamorphosis, where a projected image can only be recognized from one specific vantage point. Yet, as shown by the prologue's extensive citation of Amado's text, the errant's focus is never static and requires movement to delineate the unseen object. Only in movement, that is, departing from canonical texts and historical sites to peripheral archives and spaces, can the writer arrive at contrasting marginal voices. Decentralization and marginalized voices as exemplified by Gonsalves's evocation of Amado. Decentralization and errantry take place not only on geographical terms but in a revelatory wandering through intertexts. Glissant 16. In fact, Ugg's intertextual errantry is disclosed as the author first adopts and then relativizes the workings of Walpole's serendipity and, in the following, accepts and disavows Amato's invitation to autonomously engage with her surroundings. This departure educates the reader into a navigation of peripheral texts that is primordial for the appreciation of Ugg's main text and the array of narratives interweaved within it. Additionally, the main narrative, told in Ketton's voice, invests in intertextual errantry and decentralization as a device to depart from the literary canon and engage with Afro-Brazilian female counter-narratives. Following this decentralizing strategy outlined in the prologue, Ketton's autobiographical narrative attends not only to her memories but very often lingers on underlying narratives laid open alongside her story. Ugg builds on the semantical disparity between looking for and seeing to project many other stories inside and to the side of the protagonist's memoir which, literally, populate its 947 pages. In this respect, it renders no exaggeration to affirm that the novel's narrative is seldom focused on Ketton's personal struggle and development from an enslaved child to a successful businesswoman in Africa, but rather loses sight of her quest to disperse in the painstaking description of late colonial and early republican settings and Brazil's early socio-cultural relations. As soon as Ketton learns that her son Luis has been sold into slavery, the protagonist starts a desperate search, traveling to different localities of Brazil, such as Rio de Janeiro, Santos, and São Paulo. In her account of each stop, the former slave weaves in numerous encounters with other characters whose stories provide an intricate and heterogeneous illustration of the urban Brazilian life and socio-spatial relations in the late 19th century. Her interminable search through historical centers in Brazil sheds light on reminiscences of African daily culture as well as elements and circumstances that marked Afro-Brazilian syncretism, such as the adaptation of Yoruba and Jiji, Naga cultural practices, or the communal structures of associations formed by slaves and former slaves. The protagonist's memoiristic narrative recovers thus other fates in the agitated life of Brazilian urban centers, whose stories she wants integrated to her personal and their family story, cf. Gonçalves 662. Following its narrative structure with diverting focus hinders a clear genre classification, as critic Christina Stevens explains, Ugg cannot be characterized as a fictional narrative only, it can be read as a kind of diary. Further, it is an epic narrative of a heroine. She records in great detail these several journeys, not only from the geographical, cultural point of view, her narrative also analyses her complex, inward, psychological journeys, her incessant search for roots and identity, at the same time, the novel can be read as a historical, anthropological, sociological narrative. At last, it can be read as an epistolary novel. Stevens 201. Ketton's autobiographical account goes beyond the imaginable extent of a personal or family memoir. Along with this detailed and in-depth reconstruction of 19th-century society from the perspective of the African protagonist, prominent historical figures are also brought to life through their personal relationship to Ketton. The product is a Black-authored account of Brazilian history and culture whose textual richness and complexity conveys a multitude of narratives. This aggregating effect is at some point directly addressed by the protagonist narrator, who, self-aware of her overly detailed descriptions, admits that, "I don't even know that I remembered so many names, but as I know how bad it feels to have many unanswered questions, I try to remember every important detail of my life, to answer all the questions you may not even know you have." Gonçalves 662. My translation. Or, after giving a long explanation about your Yoruba religious beliefs, "I have no idea of what you know about the cults of my homeland, and I apologize if nothing that I tell here is of your interest, but these are things which I would have told you if we had been together, things which I enjoy knowing and I think it is important that you know them too." 577. My translation. Among the secondary characters stand out the Imam Mala Abubakar, characterized as financial and spiritual guide to most of the Malas living during that time in Bahia, the Mali revolt leader Alifa Lacuta, depicted as Ketton's acquaintance and helper, and curious figures such as the flying priest Bartolomeu Gusmao, whose adventurous flight invention with balloons has also become the inspiration for José Saramago's 1982 Memorial do Convento, briefly referred to in one of Ugg's footnotes. Evoking figures and stories from historical discourse and literary texts makes out part of Ugg's narrative strategy. As literary critic Eduardo de Assis Duarte contends, linked to the postmodern disbelief that interprets history's discourse as narrative. Ana Maria Gonçalves's text makes itself historiographic metafiction to shelter other accounts, including those dismissed as scientific sources. Origin of a possible truth of facts. In this dialogism, voices of an Afro-Brazilian memory emerge, placed at the antipodes of official history, which pushes the novel discourse into the coupling and cohabitation of disparate versions. Duarte 22:3. My translation and emphasis. As seen in the prologue summoning of Amado's convite, UGC's intricate dialogism convey antipodal spaces not only of official history but also the literary discourse. A similar venture can be seen in Kehin's claim to the early Brazilian romantic tradition, whereas the novels A Moraninha, published in 1844, and O Mosolueiro, published in 1845, both written by Joaquim Manuel de Macedo, are evoked as parts of Kehin's story. While looking for traces that might lead her to Luis in the city of Rio de Janeiro, Kehin makes acquaintance with the aspiring writer Joaquim Manuel de Macedo, soon to be one of the leading authors of the Brazilian early romanticist movement. On the occasion of their first encounter, Kehin and her friend Tomasa are talking about Tomasa's new job at the City Theater and the famous Italian singer, Candini, who had recently become the theater's main attraction. Noticing the women's talk about Candini, by whom he had become fascinated, Macedo stops at their side to eavesdrop. We were so entertained with the stories Tomasa told us that we didn't even notice. Macedo, standing still between our trays, attentively listening to our conversation about Candini. It was Bento who asked him if he wished something, to which he answered that what he most wanted in life was to know Candini, and then started posing Tomasa many questions, who could barely hide her satisfaction for being given so much attention. The young mister wanted to know where Candini lived, and when Tomasa answered it was on the Alvitor Street, he replied that this really had to be a work of the divine providence, that the saints were collaborating for him to come even closer to his muse. Ecos at that very moment he was on his way to the Alvitor Street, more precisely to the Jornal do Comercio newspaper, where he was about to leave a copy of the novel he was finishing. He looked very friendly, and I decided to ask him if he wanted to publish the novel at the newspaper, to which he answered yes, because the newspaper needed to start publishing Brazilian authors. I mentioned that I accompanied every feuilleton publication, and, after his initial astonishment, he wanted to know my opinion about them. Doubter Joaquim became very impressed by what I said. He set out to walk alongside us since we were going in the same direction, and divided his attention between the curiosity regarding the Cantarina and his desire to tell me about his book Gonçalves 698.9. My translation. In this scene, once again serendipity sets off a fortuitous encounter that weaves an intertextual thread into UGC. With his interest set on learning more about Candini, the writer turns his attention away from his path to the Jornal do Comercio to the ongoing talk of the two quituteiras. This attention to the women standing on the street side engenders a movement of diversion, which allows him a closer contact and exchange with the peripheral layer of Rio de Janeiro's social landscape, side figures and stories which will deeply influence his prose. At the time they meet, Macedo is working on the manuscripts of his later most influential novels A Moraninha and O Mosolueiro. Impressed by what Kehin had to say in their first conversation, Macedo started to look for her every Saturday, when the two of them would talk about his newest project, A Moraninha. As Macedo asks for Kehin's opinion on the developing plot, she contributes, among other ways, by providing the missing protagonist's name. Do you know something I am very proud of giving a name to the young lady in the novel, whom Macedo had called so far only Moraninha for not being able to find a fitting name yet. I don't know why, but while he read to me the passages which described the young woman, I imagined her as Carolina, the oldest daughter of Sinhazinha, since at that time both were the same age. It is a romantic and beautiful story, which both Carolina and Sinhazinha could have lived, more so because it was set almost entirely on an island, which I soon imagined to be the Itaparica Island. I wanted you to know of my role in the novel, which, besides having one story, is also part of another, mine, or ours. Because it was because of you that I ended up in São Sebastião do Rio de Janeiro and met Doutor Joaquim 699. My translation. Kehin's and Macedo's meetings make out an unusual literary collaboration, wherein a former slave is not only able to voice her personal interpretation of the narrative but even to leave her own mark imprinted on the novel's final version. Inspired by the protagonist's similarities to an old-time friend's daughter, Cahan gives name to Macedo's central character and, decades later, still holds on proudly to her creative contribution, rendering Macedo's literary work as indebted to her imaginative investment. A Moraninha is summoned not only as a contextualizing asset to her story but, further, to reclaim it as part of her own narrative, part of my story, or ours. Similarly, Cahan presents a revision of Macedo's second novel, O Moço Loiro, whose fictional narrative is disclosed as partly inspired by her close friend and former slave, Tomasa, and her insights from a peripheral stance. For this reason, so Cahan, Macedo's creation of a homonymous character in his novel should be seen as a homage, because Macedo used some stories told by her about the Independence War and the performance of the Cantarinas, and because he was also inspired by the evening gatherings that Tomasa had witnessed in the accommodations of Candini and other ladies whom she helped getting dressed. 704. My translation. Besides inspiring one of its secondary characters, Tomasa had a central influence on the plot of O Moço Loiro, providing the author with information about the Brazilian War of Independence and the intimate meetings of high society women. Moreover, hers is a unique perspective from the margins, which not only grants Macedo an insight into these intimate feminine spaces but whose contrasting glance from a lower social class also offers an incisive critique of the superficialities and decadence of the bourgeoisie that marks the tone of O Moço Loiro, redefining Tomasa as more than Macedo's secondary character and one of the main sources of information for his novel. UG decentralizes its narrative focus and reclaims Black female authorial voice. Although the narrator conceives Macedo's fictionalized representation of her friend as a homage, UG emphasizes the importance of Tomasa's creative contribution for Macedo's final narrative, who was not only inspired by her but also by her stories and observations. And yet, the extent to which Cahan's narrative is intended to trouble the writer's prestige and authority over Tomasa's stories remains unclear, a fine line left uncrossed or, one could even say, dismissed. Nevertheless, in its intertextual claims over both O Moço Loiro and A Moraninha, UG complicates the novel's presupposed narrative focus and authorial voice by tending to the influence of Afro-Brazilian women, made visible in the canon, with its depiction of the author's otherwise unaccounted Black female muses, or better said, collaborators. Cahan's narrative disrupts the stable claim of hegemonic narrative and abolishes delineated notions of center and periphery in the Brazilian literary production. In its revelatory wanderings through centered discourses and marginalized voices, the novel's sequential diversions can be seen to recall thus a further asset of Glissant's decentralizing teachings, shifting attention to marginal spaces, spaces made invisible in the city landscape and texts. The errant must learn to lead from periphery to periphery, and, reproducing the track of circular nomadism, it makes every periphery into a center. Furthermore, it abolishes the very notion of center and periphery. Glissant 29, underscoring the connections between Brazil and the Caribbean within the context of the Black diaspora in the Americas. The metonymic relation between spatial and discursive decentralization drawn in UG can be read in relation to what Glissant has identified in the Caribbean relationship to soil. In the Caribbean, observes Glissant, the consequences of European expansion, including the importation of new populations, is precisely what forms the basis for a new relationship with the land, not the absolute ontological possession regarded as sacred but the complicity of relation. 147. Dwelling on the discursive realm of the Black diaspora in the Americas, UG unfolds a complicity of relation within Brazilian literature beyond claims of possession but rather attending to the hidden intersections and interrelations in the Brazilian textual landscape. Finally, UG's envisioned encounters with Black female authorial voices opens up a discursive space for its own counter-narrative within this landscape, employing intertextuality as a mode for retrieving, in Glissant's terms, diversity within the totality and unfolding Black women's accounts laying unrealized at the margins of canonical texts and historical discourse. This dialogic strategy further decentralizes the Brazilian literary corpus, recuperating within its male-dominated discourse the excluded memories, sometimes echoed, sometimes overturned, but still struggling for the recognition of its narrative and voice. The divergent paths embarked upon in UG deem literary decentralization and intertextual errantry as modes for reclaiming these Black female voices within and beyond the margins of the Brazilian canonical tradition. Work cited Amado, Jorge 1945, Bahia de Todos os Santos, Júlia das Ruas e dos Mistérios da Cidade do Salvador, São Paulo, Editora Martins Fontes, Duarte, Eduardo de Assis 2009, Na Cartografia de Romance Brasileiro, de Fido de Cor de Ana Maria Gonçalves, in Leni, Claudia Regina et al. Culturas e Diasporas Africanas, Jus de Fora, Editora UFJF, Glissant, Eduard 1997, Poetics of Relation, Transl, Betsy Wing, Ann Arbor, University of Michigan Press, Gonçalves, Ana Maria, 2006, de Fido de Cor Rio de Janeiro, Editora Record, Manuel de Macedo, Joaquim 1844, A. Moraninha, Rio de Janeiro, Editora B. L. Garnier, 1999, O. Moço Luero, São Paulo, Editora Attica, Merton, Robert K., Barber, Eleanor, 2004, The Travels and Adventures of Serendipity, A Study in Sociological Semantics and the Sociology of Science, Princeton, Princeton UP, Silva, Ana Maria Vieira, 2012, de Fido de Cor, Escritas de Memoria, Marcus de Historia, In Anais do Ciliafro, Volume 1, Number 1, Idufu, Stevens, Cristina, 2015, Re, Writing Pain, The Theme of Violence in Contemporary Afro-Brazilian Women Novelists, Krypton, Number 56, Pages 200-208, Zizek, Slavoj, 1989, Looking Awry, In October, Volume 50, Pages 30-55.